Apollo. It's nearly 40 years since two men landed on the moon and walked there. In today's Science Show on ABC Radio National, we recall how it came to be, how people went to the moon six times between 1969 and 1972. First then, let's go back to those early days, starting with a leader who made it happen and a speech you know but probably haven't heard in full.
September the 12th, 1962, Houston, Texas.
Surely the opening vistas of space promise high costs and hardships as well as high reward. So it is not surprising that some would have us stay where we are a little longer, to rest, to wait. But this country of the United States was not built by those who waited and rested and wished to look behind them. No nation which expects to be the leader of other nations can expect to stay behind in this race for space. For space science, like nuclear science and all technology, has no conscience of its own. Whether it will become a force for good or ill depends on man. And only if the United States occupies a position of preeminence can we help decide whether this new ocean will be a sea of peace or a new terrifying theater of war. We choose to go to the moon in this decade because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills, for we have given this program a high national priority. Even though I realize that this is, in some measure, an act of faith and vision, for we do not now know what benefits await us. New hopes for knowledge and peace are there. And therefore, as we set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which man has ever embarked.
John Kennedy in 1962. Let's now try and recapture the excitement of Apollo 11.
100 feet, 3.5 down, 9 forward. 875 feet, guys looking good, down a half. 60 seconds, lights on. 30 feet down, 2.5, picking up some dust. 30 feet, 2.5 down, straight shadow. 4 forward, drifting to the right a little. 3.5, 30 seconds forward, just contact light. Okay, engine stop, ATA at a descent. Hold control, both auto descent, engine command override off, 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue.
Thank you. Okay, Houston, I'm on the porch.
Roger, Neil.
And we're getting a picture on the TV.
Okay. You got a good picture, huh?
There's a great deal of contrast in it, and currently it's upside down on our monitor, but we can make out a fair amount of detail.
I'm at the foot of the ladder. The LAM footbeds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. I'm going to step off the LAM now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
We've come to the conclusion that this has been far more than three men on a voyage to the moon. More even than the efforts of one nation. We feel that this stands as a symbol of the insatiable curiosity of all mankind to explore the unknown. Neil's statement the other day upon first setting foot on the surface of the moon: this is a small step for a man, but a great leap for mankind, I believe sums up these feelings very nicely. We accepted the challenge of going to the moon. The acceptance of this challenge was inevitable. The relative ease with which we carried out our mission, I believe, is a tribute to the timeliness of that acceptance. Today, I feel we're fully capable of accepting expanded roles in the exploration of space. In retrospect, we've been particularly pleased with the emblem of our flight, depicting the U.S. Eagle, bringing the universal symbol of peace from the Earth to the Moon, that symbol being the olive branch. It was our overall crew choice to deposit a replica of this symbol on the Moon. Personally, in reflecting the events of the past several days, a verse from the Psalms comes to mind to me. When I consider the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him?
Well, the American broadcasts of the landing were hosted by Walter Cronkite. Australia had Dr. Peter Pockley. Here are his thoughts on the event.
For nearly 4 years, an electronic umbilical cord joined me to the Apollo astronauts. Our umbilical was a simple voice circuit, a pair of wires, if you like, with the occasional communication satellite joining the loose ends. It brought together the voices of the astronauts, put them through the placenta of Mission Control in Houston, Texas, and carried the combined sounds to me and my colleagues in the ABC Science Unit here in Sydney. Unlike the biological situation, though, our umbilical flowed in one direction only, from them to us. Frustratingly, we had absolutely no communication the other way. We were simply eavesdroppers on a stream of voices, some earthbound, some spacebound. These were carried on a private line which Mission Control kept open continuously to the tracking stations throughout the world. The line was dubbed, rather grandly, the Voice of Apollo. I learned of its existence after struggling to present adequate broadcasts of the first manned flights of the Apollo project. Apollo 7, which orbited the Earth for 11 days in October 68, and Apollo 8, which took three men around the Moon on Christmas Eve of the same year. For those broadcasts, we patched together whatever actuality material we could understand from the wheeze and whine of shortwave broadcasts. For me, and I'm sure for our listeners, we were just mildly interested observers of the space game, from a distance and in disconnected snatches. We did try to improve things by getting our correspondents in the US to lift the sound from American broadcasts and feed that to us by the compact cable, at no small expense to the ABC, but this was very cumbersome to set up and could not provide the authoritative and locally relevant information needed for Australian audiences. But all that changed for our broadcasts of Apollo 9, which in March 69 went into orbit around the Moon and test flew the lunar lander, and Apollo 10 in May, the exciting dress rehearsal, when the lunar lander Snoopy swooped down to and around the grey mountains of the Moon. For these broadcasts, we obtained an exclusive phone tap of the voice of Apollo as it passed through Sydney to the tracking station near Canberra. And because it didn't cost us a cent, the pontiffs of the ninth floor were in no pickle about our virtual full-time occupation of a studio. We linked the voice of Apollo into what we, in turn, rather grandly called the ABC's Apollo Studio, and at least one of us listened to it without break throughout every day and often throughout the night. When we didn't broadcast live the predictable key events, we recorded every other moment, including large chunks of hiss, or hash as the jargon had it, in case something vital was missed. Oh, this, incidentally, was how we managed to beat probably every radio station in the world with broadcasts within minutes of the explosion on Apollo 13 during a dull period of transit to the Moon in April 70, and how radio stayed for days with a heart-stopping story of bringing Jim Lovell, Jack Swigert and Fred Hayes safely back to Earth. Well, the audio quality of the voice of Apollo was just electrifying. And as we relayed in our broadcasts the clipped voices of the astronauts and controllers, seldom betraying any strain or emotion, it riveted us and our growing audiences. It was a true radio event, and for later missions, of course, also a television event, but I like to think that radio was king, because we not only packed our broadcasts with live drama and information, but the very sounds of voices from space were the seeds of countless millions of imaginary journeys to the moon by the eavesdroppers. The later television pictures from the moon and the rather crude gee whiz presentation they got from the studios tended, I think, to diminish and eventually demolish that imaginative element. As I clocked up the days and nights of listening to the voice of Apollo and interpreting it on air, I got so involved with the men out there that intuitively I could feel precisely when, after a period of hash, they were going to speak and almost what they were going to say. My extrasensory game with the astronauts was never to speak when they did. This was all good training for the big one, for Apollo 11, of course, when I was to lead the most extensive and complex live broadcasts ever staged by ABC Radio for days at a stretch. I was hooked up to two sets of headphones and had every conceivable backup for variety and safety in case the voice of Apollo dropped out, including the ABC's first and probably only live open telephone line for talkback, without the regulation 7-second delay to protect sensitive ears from expletives or profanities. A senior executive had agreed to our requests for great chunks of airtime because, as he put it, broadcasts of the moon landing and walk would be the greatest thing since sliced bread. But pity me if I spoke when the Eagle landed on the moon, or when Neil Armstrong decided to deliver his little script as he dusted his boots with lunar soil. I didn't. On listening back to some of our broadcasts, I think they do reflect the tenor of the times. A mood pervades this oral record, which no volumes of the printed word can adequately recall. We laced our broadcasts with loads of straight information about the what and the how and the why of it all. Our listeners seemed wrapped in the medical, the chemical, the physical, the technological, the statistical, the geological, the electronic information we poured out in between the moments of tension as the astronauts passed yet one more dangerous moment. There was little of today's emphasis on the social relevance of science and the so-called evils of technology. There were cynics about the space game, and at the time I was fairly sceptical about the benefits of taking men to the moon. It seemed to me then that only the geologists needed to have trained collectors on the moon, and that all other significant experiments could eventually be done by remote control with unmanned vehicles. I thought, and still hold to this view, that we didn't have to have such an expensive rush. It could still have been achieved at a slower pace, without the letdown, and the widespread critical backlash against technology in general, which followed NASA's rather overblown exercise in self-justification. The technological spin-offs were real, but they probably spun more in the direction of the military than the civilian uses of space. Yet, 10 years ago, I was in continual contact with some outstanding civilian scientists who were independent souls and were quite enormously excited about the observations of man on the moon. To me, I guess these people provided the major justification for the whole exploit. Unfortunately, they were generous in sharing their feelings with the millions of non-experts. And it's this that makes me feel that if men were going first to the moon today rather than 10 years ago, we'd probably be hearing broadcasts of the event in much the same way as before, though with somewhat less excitement and certainly less optimism.
Neil and Buzz, the President of the United States is in his office now and would like to say a few words to you, over.
That would be an honor.
Go ahead, Mr. President. This is Houston out.
Hello, Neil and Buzz. I'm talking to you by telephone from the Oval Room at the White House. And this certainly has to be the most historic telephone call ever made. I just can't tell you how proud we all are of what you... For every American, this has to be the proudest day of our lives. And for people all over the world, I am sure they too join with America in recognizing what an immense feat this is. Because of what you have done, the heavens have become a part of man's world. And as you talk to us from the Sea of Tranquility, it inspires us to redouble our efforts to bring peace and tranquility to Earth. For one priceless moment in the whole history of man, all the people on this Earth are truly one. One in their pride in what you have done, and one in our prayers that you will return safely to Earth.
Thank you, Mr. President. It's a great honor and privilege for us to be here representing
not only the United States, but men of peace of all nations, men with interest and a curiosity, and men with a vision for the future.
And thank you very much, and I look forward, all of us look forward, to seeing you on the Hornet on Thursday.
One of the experts at hand during the Apollo broadcasts was Dr. Ross Taylor, a geologist at the Australian National University. Dr. Taylor was chosen to study the first samples brought back in Apollo 11. Here's how it happened.
It was one of these interesting series of long coincidences in one's career. I'd become interested in analytical work of geological samples. I'd developed techniques, and it so happened that these techniques were selected for the analysis of the first lunar samples. And so when NASA found themselves faced with this problem of analysing rocks from another planet, I got summoned to go to Houston to show them the techniques.
And so you were there when the Apollo 11 rock came back, were you?
Yes, this was when the first sample was returned. I remember the date very well. It was July the 28th, 1969, when we actually got our hands on the sample.
How much did they bring back then? Was it a lot?
They brought back, on the first mission, about 22 kilograms of rocks and soil.
What were you expecting?
Well, we were expecting possibly volcanic rocks, but we didn't really know. We were expecting a lot of meteorite debris, which we didn't find, and a lot of the predictions, in fact, turned out to be falsified by our analyses. We discovered that the samples, in fact, were different in quite a lot of the chemical composition from terrestrial samples.
Well, of course, you've been analysing moon rock for years. In fact, I think it was something like 7 years ago I sat here in your office in Canberra and held some moon. In these years, when you've been doing the analysis, what have you found?
Well, the samples have enabled us to reconstruct the early history of the moon and its evolution over about 4.5 billion years. The moon has showed evidence of very early melting. Unlike the Earth, we have a record of the events in the Moon going back almost to the beginning of the condensation of the solar system, whereas on the Earth, the first almost 1 billion years is quite obscured.
The samples you've had are very small indeed, aren't they? How do you get from a small piece of moon rock to that conclusion about the evolution of the Moon?
Well, fortunately, the Moon is a lot simpler than the Earth. We have quite good control on where the samples come from in the surface. We have a lot of photography of the lunar surface. We're able to place the samples into the appropriate sort of context. And by establishing the age and the chemical composition, comparing that with the samples from the Earth, with samples from meteorites, and models of the early composition of the solar nebula from which the planet's condensed, we're able to construct geochemical models to fit all the analytical details, and so enable us to say that the outer half of the moon probably was melted, that it crystallized, and that this happened almost at the beginning of the moon's history, and from that time on almost very little happened.
You've had through your laboratory something like 100 grams of moon. Is it used up in the process of analysis, or do you have to give it back, or what?
About a quarter of it is consumed in the analytical operation, and the rest has to be very rigorously accounted for and returned to Houston. And we have on occasion had inspections from NASA to make sure we are accounting properly for this material.
Is there anything special about moon rock? I mean, if someone brought in something and said, this is moon, Dr. Taylor, would you be able to do various tests and say, ah, indeed?
Well, yes, we would, but it would take quite sophisticated equipment because many of the lunar samples resemble terrestrial rocks, basalt rocks of this sort. We could certainly make that decision quite easily, but it would require a very complicated analytical technique. It's not a thing you could do just by looking at it.
What does that anniversary mean to you?
Well, it certainly was, I think, the most important thing I've done in my life, if that's a reasonable answer. I realised subsequently that all my previous career had effectively been preparing me for this kind of moment, to analyse a sample from another planet. I think it was certainly the most critical thing I've done, and it took every ounce of effort and knowledge which I had at the time to carry out those analyses.
What about the mission itself? Have your ideas changed about the value of that sort of exploration?
Well, the Russians have had 3 missions to the moon, returned a few grams of soil using unmanned landers, so the question is whether one could have done the whole thing somewhat more cheaply than sending men. The complication is that it's extremely difficult to unscramble this material to extract useful chemical information, useful information about the age of the moon, the origin, evolution, the things I've been talking about. It's as though you took all the packets and tins and bottles in the kitchen, emptied them all in a heap in the floor, and then tried to work out what the components of the mixture were. The point about the manned missions was that the astronauts picked up the individual rock samples. So given those, of course, we could sort out what the mixture was. But if we'd only had the mixture to work with from an unmanned mission, we would have, I think, had very great difficulty. Now, of course, we know how to handle these sort of samples, so we could quite easily deal with an unmanned sample, say returning some soil from Mars or from Mercury. But before the manned missions, we wouldn't have known.
Dr. Ross Taylor is Professorial Fellow at the School of Earth Sciences at the Australian National University. Of course, Australia played no small part in the Apollo missions. Our tracking stations were crucial, and at the one at Honeysuckle Creek, I spoke to Ian Grant and Hamish Lindsay, who told me about the role they played, and also how much they feel that people have forgotten about Apollo.
Around Canberra, where I have given lectures and talks to various people and groups, I find that they seem to know about Armstrong, they know about Apollo 11, but when it comes to any further details, they all seem to fail. Just recently I did have somebody who said, "What was Apollo?"
Was that a child?
No, it was an adult. It surprised me quite a bit. They just never heard of Apollo.
Ian Grant, what was the role of Australia and your tracking station at the time to cover the mission?
Well, basically the role of Honeysuckle Creek plus other stations associated at Tibbambilla was to provide a radio frequency link with the spacecraft. We collect voice circuits from them. We also tracked the spacecraft. We provided Doppler readouts to Houston.
Were you actually covering one of the key events, such as the landing or the first walk?
Yes, Honeysuckle covered the step onto the moon. The initial walk was actually run through Honeysuckle.
To the world.
So to the world.
So, obviously, you had a great responsibility. What was the atmosphere like in the tracking station when you were virtually bringing the world that kind of signal?
I can remember I was coming off shift. We used to do 12.5-hour shifts, and we all waited a little bit just to see him step onto the moon itself. Even though we'd been through other missions, we all knew that this was something special.
Everything went to plan. There were no gremlins.
On Apollo 11, it was very smooth. The only excitement was the landing of the Lamb when there was something like 20 seconds of fuel left on board. They had, in fact, to traverse a rock field and so forth.
Yes, they brought it down manually, didn't they?
Yes, their landing radar, in fact, was overloaded, and Roedel had to land manually. So there wasn't too much margin left. That was an exciting time.
In front of me, you've got actually the printouts of the heartbeats, is it, of both Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin as they stepped onto the moon. And Buzz Aldrin is, what, 81 beats per minute, and Neil Armstrong 112. So Buzz was quite calm when he stepped onto the moon.
Yes, he appeared to be quite a calm man.
Hamish, going back to the kind of reactions you get from the public, how much do people know about the rockets, the techniques, the whole, I suppose, nuts and bolts and so on?
Well, a lot of the technicalities didn't get through to people. I think the size of the rocket. The rocket was 363 feet high, 111 metres. And the stunning fact to me is it took nearly 2,000 tonnes of fuel to get that thing into the air to 6,000 miles an hour from stop in 2.5 minutes. And that's consuming fuel at something like 13.6 tonnes a second. Now, you have to imagine a road tanker just gobbled up in a second. And its sole purpose, its whole job, was there for 2.5 minutes to get that whole stack, as they called it, into the air up to about 37 miles.
What happened to that rocket after the 2.5 minutes?
The first stage dropped off into the Atlantic. The second stage then took over.
When it was up in orbit, wasn't it Australia, Carnarvon Station, which gave the go-ahead for them to head off to the moon?
Yes, Carnarvon was one of the Earth support stations which defined the Earth orbit and would give them the go-ahead for injection to translunar flight.
Well, now these days are over. Do you miss it?
Yes, I think once one has contributed to a series of Apollo missions, that it's very difficult to get back to a more normal routine sort of job again. It was a very exciting time in one's life, there was no doubt about that.
Yes, it was a tremendous build-up. For many, many years there, we grew with the whole system. Then came Apollo 11, and that was the pinnacle of it. Then the following missions, I guess the interest has waned to some extent, and time becomes a problem here. To get away from the Earth takes years and years to get away to these further planets. We were very lucky, both of us, to have gone through that period and been part of one of the greatest steps man can ever take. And life has become a lot quieter and a lot more mundane, I guess, since the days of Apollo 11.
Hamish Lindsay and Ian Grant at Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station. Well, after six successful missions with 12 Americans walking on the lunar surface and all the unmanned exploration and surveying done by them and the Russians, how much did we learn? Last year, you may have heard that great amateur astronomer Patrick Moore in The Science Show answering those questions. This is what he said.
Well, I think it's fair to say, you know, that all our ideas about the moon have been completely revolutionised by Apollo. I remember the time, and it's not so very long ago, when the moon was generally regarded by professional astronomers as rather dull and parochial when nothing ever happened. And therefore, mapping the moon was left very largely to the amateurs, of which I was one, and we did produce the original moon maps, and of course they were useful at the time, even though they've been completely superseded now. But cast your mind back only to the early 1960s. There was a theory, widely popularised, that the moon's maria, that's to say the dried-up seas, if you can call them seas, were in fact nothing but beds of soft dust. One very eminent authority stated quite categorically that any spacecraft landing there would simply sink out of sight with all its gear. And as I've always said, after a journey of 250,000 miles through space, that would be rather disappointing. But that theory was current right up to the mid-1960s, although I never believed in it myself, and I think that illustrates how little we did then know about the moon. The first real breakthrough came, of course, with the close-range photography of the surface, and that was done by the American orbiters. Previously, way back in 1959, the Russians had sent Luna 3 round to the back of the moon and photographed the far side, but that did really turn out to be much as we'd expected, mountains and craters and furor of the Maria. And then came the first genuine soft landing, when the Russian lunar probe actually landed on the surface and didn't sink out of sight. And really, our modern knowledge of the moon, I think, dates from that point. But of course, now we have got analyses of the surface rocks, and they are essentially of volcanic type. They're not quite the same as our volcanic rocks, because they've been produced under rather different circumstances. After all, remember, the moon is a small body, and the surface gravity is only 1/6 of our own, and there's nothing now in the way of an atmosphere, and probably, I think, never was an atmosphere like ours. We know now that the moon is definitely hot inside, not so hot as the Earth near the core, but certainly not cold, as people used to think. What we don't really know, even now, is how the majority of those craters got there. And the moon, after all, is absolutely dominated by craters. You find them everywhere. And there have been two schools of thought, two main schools of thought. I mean, there were others. I remember one paper published some time ago in which it was seriously claimed that the craters were nothing more or less than coral atolls. And I don't think that sounds very likely. And then, of course, there was Senor Sixto Ocampo, the Spanish engineer, and he published a lovely theory about the moon's craters. And this was the atomic bomb theory. And on his theory, the moon used to be inhabited. There was a war, of course. The two sides destroyed each other with atomic weapons, produced the craters. And the fact that some craters have got central peaks and others haven't shows, naturally, that the two sides used different kinds of bombs.
But which of the main two theories do you subscribe to?
Well, the two main theories are the impact theory, according to which the moon's craters were produced by a kind of cosmical bombardment, and what you can loosely call the volcanic theory. Volcanic is rather a dangerous term, because no one is suggesting that the big craters on the moon are similar to our volcanoes. What I mean is, on the volcanic theory, they are of internal origin. And although there's no doubt, I think, that both processes have operated, there are impact craters, there are volcanic craters, my own view is that volcanism has been the most prominent mechanism, and I think the big craters are of internal origin. But of course, no one really agrees.
Patrick, say the shuttle works extremely well, and by the turn of the century, with luck, you'll be hale and healthy. Would you like to go and travel in the planets?
I would love to go, and I'm under no delusions that I will. My dear chap, in 10 years I shall be 65, and I think that's about the time when non-specialists can be expected to go up in shuttles. So I'm afraid, and I personally am going to miss it. Much as I'd love to go to the moon, I have at least had the fun of being involved in the very early stages, even in my own humble capacity as a mere observer.
Patrick Moore, the British astronomer. Dr. Earl Hackett, at the time a member of Peter Pockley's team of experts in the ABC Apollo studio. Earl Hackett had this to say.
When the moon becomes our number one satellite, it'll be a serious business for writers of verses. There's only one rhyme for satellite, and that's patellite, which means someone interested in the welfare of kneecaps. I met him on our satellite, oh, list ye while I tell. He said, I am a patellite, and kneecaps I do sell. Not very good, really, is it? Of course, there'll still be the sun, but the rhymes for sun are surprisingly few and very dull, like overdone and run and stun and such like. But for real good rhymes, give me moon. Oon is such a lovely syllable. To demonstrate which, I'll now rhyme it 34 times. Oh, let me give tune to a loving lampoon, for darling, 'tis soon we shall walk on the moon before it is strewn by a Yankee platoon with flag and maroon and drum and bassoon and beer and spittoon and TV and cartoon. Come, let me dragoon you to eat macaroon in a lunar saloon by a dusty lagoon on a warm afternoon with no fear of typhoon or simoon or monsoon or raccoon or baboon or buffoon or poltroon or a Marshall McLoon to upset our pontoon. I will deck and festoon you with hat and balloon, so sweet and jejune in your space-going shoon, nicely frilled with galloon, and your blouse of gambroon, matching wide pantaloon, all tabs and godroon. Why the gussets unscroon? For to spend a doubloon, oh, my darling, I swoon.
Surface is fine and powdery. I can pick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere to in fine layers, like powdered charcoal, to the sides of my boot. I only go in a small fraction of an inch, maybe an eighth of an inch, but I can see the footprints of my boots and the treads in the fine, sandy particles. It has a stark beauty all its own. It's like much of the high desert of United States. It's different, but it's very pretty out here.
Pretty, but dirty. The dust covered everything, including the astronauts. They looked like they'd been down a coal mine when they rejoined Michael Collins. And it was sticky.